He's doing a number of very important and unconventional things. He's currently heading up a community called, it was Missio Dei, but it's now called the Mennonite Worker. You just changed your name now, what?
October 1st.
That's pulling together the two traditions, I think, that most influenced them, one being their Mennonite affiliation and tradition, the other being the Catholic Worker, which a number of us may be familiar with. Mark and I went to seminary together a few years ago. He was somebody who was always asking the really challenging questions. And 6 years ago? Wow, 6 years ago. Tended to make people uncomfortable quite a bit, and I see that nothing has changed as I sit down and talk with him. And that's one of the reasons that we really wanted to invite him here. As we were thinking about this conference, it's not just about thinking through how does a church relate to politics and things like that. We have to get even more specific, and I think one of the ways we get more specific is grappling with economics. And I tried to think about folks around the Twin Cities who are good models of this in the way that they live out their community life together and the way that they understand their public witness with all of that. And it was surprising how few communities I could actually come up with, or we could come up with here as a staff. But the first one I thought of was Mark and some of the work that they're doing there and their emphasis on radical hospitality. And he'll describe some of what that means and some of what that looks like for them. They're in the Cedar Riverside neighborhood. Aside from this community, which your focus is prayer, simplicity, hospitality, peacemaking, and resistance. Yeah. A really amazing vision. He's got this community. He also is, if anybody of you have stumbled across the website, the Jesus Radicals, it's kind of a clearinghouse for a lot of folks grappling with Christian anarchism. Okay, and he'll also talk about that a little bit. But some really incredible and insightful writings are appearing there. What I appreciate about it, it's not just those who... They're very open to those who are submitting articles. So it's you get a little bit of everything on there. I'd encourage you to check it out if you haven't seen it yet. The other thing is a podcast where they've interviewed some incredible folks called the Iconocast. It's also on the website, so check that out. And finally, he's doing some grassroots education with a group with something called the Rootworks, and they're experimenting with some alternative forms of education to deal with some of the issues that we're bringing up here, but also I'm sure some issues that he'll raise here. So Mark, it's good to have you here. It's good to see you again, and look forward to what you have to share with us.
I know the word anarchism is thrown out. I want to take the power of that scary word away. Thank you. One of the funny things about anarchists is, you know, usually they're very serious about it and kind of a little bit mean sometimes. And I try not to be either of those things very often. But for a while, like this, just to give you full disclosure, this is the first election I'll be voting in for probably at least a decade. Because a lot of anarchists don't like voting. And I want to give you, I say that not to say, look at me, I'm voting, or look at me, I didn't vote for 10 years. But to say that the last person I voted for was George W. Bush. And it's funny because I was planning on sharing this. I didn't know, we didn't arrange it ahead of time to have this connection about I'm proud to be an American. But just to give you a sense, I'm not, you know, some people voted for Bush. And they just voted for Bush. I voted for Bush. Okay. I get the voted. When I was in high school, my senior high school picture, if you were to, I've posted this on Facebook because I love the reaction. I'm wearing a red, white, and blue rodeo shirt with a blue bolo tie, and upon my head, I've always been a hat man, is a, you know, Stetson cowboy hat with a rattlesnake skin hat band. And I was wearing that one day when I was at Valley Fair. And at the end of the night, they used to do this. I don't know if they do this anymore, but I was with my friends, and they used to do this fireworks laser show. The only thing more awesome than fireworks and the only thing more awesome than lasers is fireworks and lasers together. And the big crescendo at the end of the night was I'm Proud to Be an American by Lee Greenwood. And as the fireworks burst and the lasers were lazing, I started to weep openly and joyously over my profound nationalistic patriotism. Now, this is interesting, though. When I first became a Christian when I was in my teens, I was in conservative kind of farm, lakes, country, Minnesota. And they gave me a Bible and said, just read it and start with the gospel. So I read it, and this is where it gets kind of sad. I just automatically assumed that I needed to be a pacifist and that I should like poverty somehow. I kind of took it the Franciscan way initially as the first read, partly because I'd never read the Bible before. I'd never really gone to church, and I'd only read, like, books. So I didn't have this really kind of weird, magical way of reading the Bible. I kind of took it. Like, there's this thing. I assumed Jesus probably means it, and Revelation is poetic. And I came to quickly realize that it's supposed to be the other way around. And so I remember two instances, because I went to a charismatic, very charismatic church. And I remember in Sunday school, it was like Veterans Day. It was nearby or something, and it was Sunday. And they were taking prayer requests, and I said, I want to pray that God will forgive all of our World War II vets for murder. I wasn't being radical. See, John says I like to make people uncomfortable. It's never really intentional. I'm a pretty earnest person. So I wasn't trying to make a point. In fact, I would have been conservative at the time. I just thought, well, this is what being Christian is like. I wept and accepted Jesus, so now I have to make good. And now this is... So there's that. And so the response was, I had about an hour of deliverance done on me to cast out the spirit of rebellion. Right? A year later, I remember... You think it would be done, and I would have conformed. But a year later, I remember we had a dental assistant who was one of our youth leaders, and she had a brand new Corvette. And I lived in Becker County, right off of White Earth Indian Reservation, and I was from a poor family, so I was angry about wealthy people. And so when she had this nice, fancy car, I remember when she came in, I said, think of all the people you could have fed if you didn't buy that stupid car. And so I had actually had more deliverance done casting the spirit of poverty on me. Now, it'd be funny, but... The reality is when you're a teenager sitting in a chair with a group of people, adults, putting their hands on you, yelling demons out of you, it's kind of traumatizing, to say the least. Now, little did they realize that they hadn't bound the strong man, because those demons came back with seven of their friends. And the irony is, today, if I were to go back in time, the person I am today, I would assume that I am demonic. And I'm pretty sure the Christianity of my youth, from my perspective now, is demonic. So the question is, and this is just funny, like when my people I grew up with say, I don't think you're a Christian anymore, I'm like, from your perspective, I'm not. I'm not a Christian anymore. And I don't say this because I try to be generous and inclusive, but my think in my head, judgmental thoughts about I don't think you are either. Because what does it mean to be a Christian? I don't believe in hell. I'm just going to throw that out there. So once you take that out of there, being Christian doesn't mean whether you're going to go to the happy place or bad place when you die. It's whether you look like Jesus or not. It's pretty much the only definition of Christian I'm really interested in. I say all that to kind of show that for me, all this stuff I'm going to talk about, I kind of come at it from a very... awkward and humble place. I didn't really become a radical until I was well into my 20s, already married. I was not a young radical idealist in my youth. I'm becoming an old radical, and I'm getting more radical with age, which is exactly in contrast to how society says it's supposed to go. So I find myself feeling more and more discomfort as I get older because I'm losing more and more of my friends, not by any choice of my own. And I've come to realize that for me, the central value that I feel like I'm trying to embody in my life is one of repentance. And the challenge is to start seeing that as good news. And ultimately, what I'm here to talk about this morning is a call to repentance, which people don't use that word anymore, especially people like me who are kind of leftist. It's kind of a weird religious word. We don't like name, lots of churches don't even like using the S word anymore, sin. We don't do a call to repentance. We talk about social justice, but we disconnect it from spirituality, so we don't have repentance that goes with it. And so then justice becomes about that, and it doesn't become about this. just to give you more context so you know where I'm coming from. So it's not just that my views have changed. We started making weird decisions. Monsieur Day is, next year will be 10 years old, which isn't very old for a church, but for an intentional community, it's almost ancient. Most intentional communities don't last because young people get married and they decide to get a job and they decide to be respectable. And so if you're mostly young people in an intentional community, you think it's going to go away pretty quickly in a few years, but we've managed to stick with it. And along the way, we've learned some things. We didn't actually start as an intentional community. I was supposed to be a young, hip, urban church planter starting the Baptist General Conference version of Solomon's Porch. And about a year into it, we were actually succeeding towards that, but I hated it. Not that churches are bad, but I just felt like I kind of just could see God up in heaven kind of looking down like, Mark, you know, you could do better than that. You can conform and just do what you're supposed to do, or you can just really just, it's like what Jen was saying the first night. Can you do something unique, a unique contribution to the Twin Cities? Or are you just going to do your own Baptist brand of the same thing? And so I fired myself from being a pastor. And I said, hey, if you're interested in this stuff, let's go on a retreat. And everyone left, except for the people that happened to be receiving hospitality from us in our house, and two seminary buddies. And so we gathered around, and we re-envisioned and started as an intentional community by accident. I didn't know that there was a thing called New Monasticism. Shane Claiborne hadn't published his book. I had no idea what we were doing. And we started making mistakes that were helpful in making us wise. And so this is basically what we look like today. We have two hospitality houses, which isn't a lot. I mean, we're not starting the big movement that's going to change the world yet. Two hospitality houses, and they're made up of people that are members of our community and people who are residents with us for a time, and then guests. And if you visit, you can't really tell who's who, and that's intentional. And we do hospitality in the Catholic worker sense, where we welcome strangers. Hospitality is, by definition, love of strangers. If they're your friends, it's just what you're supposed to do. It's not technically hospitality. That's just being a friend. Hospitality is always with the stranger. And to me, this is interesting to me, like the way in which hospitality functions. And I'm just going to get a little bit ahead of myself before I go back to what our community looks like. There's all sorts of interesting social conventions around hospitality in the ancient world. One of them is in Greek culture, which for sure inspired the imaginations a little bit in the New Testament. Technically, if you had a guest, they had a term for Zeus that was Zeus the stranger. Your guest could be Zeus in disguise, which sounds a lot like something we'd say about Jesus, right? And you weren't even supposed to, by etiquette, even ask the person's name until after you've sat them down, they've got their shoes off, and fed them. Then you had the right to ask their name. Because they were honored, you weren't supposed to be skeptical until you already broke bread, which we know in the ancient world is a much bigger deal than breaking bread for us mostly today. And the words that we get, hospitality, is from Latin and the Greek, philoxenos, love of stranger, can also mean love of host. These words are, there's an embedded mutuality in these words. So hospitality is the place where you love the stranger and the love of the host are coming together. Strangers and host, it's a flattening thing. In the ancient world, hospitality was equal. We've turned hospitality into some sort of client relationship. So it's almost always condescending, almost everywhere I've experienced it in any substantial way when you have someone giving hospitality to strangers. So for us, we thought this was problematic because the whole Jesus stuff is about Jesus' table was this radical thing. He'd eat with people he wasn't supposed to eat with, and it was offensive precisely because he was declaring a sense of pure relationship with these horrible sinners. Right? That's the only reason it was offensive, is because if you ate with them, then you're like them. Right? If Jesus was just doing a nice deed, the Pharisees would have been all okay with it. Yeah, those sinners need some help. But he was breaking bread with them, and it was fellowship. And if that sort of radical inclusivity and equality is supposed to be a root way of understanding us as the body of Christ gathered around the table, then for us as a community, we had to figure out how to do hospitality in a way that was non-condescending. And so we started doing some things that have kind of anchored us as a community. One, we started privileging guests on the fast track to being a member. Before that, we had lots of people who'd come from like far off and random places who tried to move into the simple way, and they were full, so they started looking for other communities, and they looked on the web, and they found us, and they wanted to join our community. And it's cool. You get these young radical idealists coming. It's very good for infusing you with energy and sometimes even money. But we privilege guests who don't really bring any of that to them. We also decided to... We're a community that is a working community. None of us, like, besides me, I guess, I raise money outside of the community, but the rest of us all work to make ends meet, and we have to figure out a way to pay for houses together. And we decided that we would never factor in someone's ability to contribute in doing discernment for them being a part of our community, which, again, maybe doesn't, from a church perspective, church membership, it's you don't usually have to think about that too much. Maybe you expect them to tithe. But for our community, it's a question of whether or not we're going to be able to keep our homes. But we decided to privilege guests to the point of not even inquiring about how much what they can do for us. So a lot of these things started filtering in. We started sharing resources around grocery shopping. We have like two cars for 20 people in our between our two houses. We garden and do lots of things that are economic together. And I give that as a context just to say that I feel like what we're doing is rather humble. There's just a couple households. It's not like we don't have a vast network of households. But for us, it's a way of exploring economics on a practical level, which almost all of us, when we hear the word economics, our brain probably goes to the abstract. And we keep it abstract. And economics becomes about how we affect the whole. And then we don't really stop and think about what is the economics right in front of me every day. I got a little bit ahead of myself. I'm going to go back. We got a lot of great analysis last night. I want to give a little bit more analysis just to kind of highlight a little bit what I'm saying. You know, we have heard this. It only took a few hundred years for Christianity to get really entwisted within the Roman Empire. We know this. It's kind of well documented. There have been all sorts of books written about it. And it's interesting, though, like how much we think about that as like pre-Constantine, and then there's Constantine, and then we're trying to be post-Constantine, and all we have to do is somehow claim that, and we're good. We have this mistaken idea, like I've heard people say this, like, you know, you start mentioning the Crusades or genocide or any nasty thing, and someone will always say this, yeah, but they weren't real Christians. And somehow, when they say that, there's this magic thing that happens. Now there's this magical category of real Christianity that we don't know if it's really ever existed, by the way, except for maybe early on. And they probably were trying to make themselves sound pretty good, let's just be honest. And they had problems. So there's this real Christianity, and somehow by claiming, yeah, but they weren't real Christians, the silent parenthetical thought is, but I am. And amazing, everywhere you go, this society is filled with people who are real Christians, who if they were there back during the time of the Crusades, or the genocide of the indigenous cultures, or enslavement, they wouldn't have done it. And this is a very pervasive myth, because we think somehow that all of our oppression is in the past tense. It's done. Thank God we don't oppress people anymore. And we don't stop and think about the fact that within that, maybe even our most cherished doctrines are still tainted with imperialism. That somehow Christianity as a pure doctrine doesn't exist over here in this nebulous, glorious, spiritual form. That all I have to do is say, those are the bad Christians, and then you can just take this and say, we're going to be a goal and be ahistorical now and just base ourselves off of this because we can read the Bible rightly. We haven't been, our imagination hasn't been infected by empire at all. We can just read the Bible and do what it says. Dr. Charles, last night, he said, you know, the problem is Jesus. If we can just get rid of him, we can be as imperial as we want, I'm paraphrasing him. And that's true. I mean, you think about it, Christianity is uniquely suited as an imperial religion. I mean, take traditional readings of Genesis about subduing the land, mix in a little bit of the lordship of Christ, which gives his followers socio-religious superiority. Mix that with the evangelical impulse of the Great Commission, which giving us a mandate to extend the rule and subjugation of the land to the ends of the earth. And all you need to do is figure out how to get Jesus to be not that serious about what he says, and you can be an imperial religion. It's why Rome loved it so much. It's perfect. It's one of the first truly universal and universalizing religions. It's great. It's perfect for empire if you can figure out what to do with Jesus. And of course we have. Like I come from a family of Tea Party people. and so I have great Facebook conversations. And like my sister, she wrote something about how the President Obama, who is a secret Muslim, by the way, needs to have a JFK moment. She wrote on her Facebook. Yeah. So I quickly reported her to Facebook so that they would take it down before somebody who in a position of power could see it, because I love my sister and don't want her to be put in a dark cell because she basically threatened the life of the president on Facebook. But that wasn't the disturbing part, because I know my sister enough to know she's being horribly in bad humor about it. What disturbed me was, and my family's probably going to listen to this. If this goes out on the internet, we're recording it, right? Who cares? They need to hear this. My stepmother quickly responded, "Amen." Now, my stepmom is like a very devout Christian. And so I quickly jumped on her and said, "Hey, how can you follow the Jesus who says, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, and say amen to that?" And it's amazing, like, I think it's fascinating. My family criticizes me for being too intellectual. But the amount of intellectual gymnastics that one has to do to somehow reconcile those two ideas, which a vast number of Christians do in this country, is astonishing. How intellectual anti-intellectuals can be is amazing. It's the most complex thought. It brings logic into this new form of logic that you need a special secret decoder ring to even understand how it makes sense. So if you add to this the willingness to use violence, you have a very potent form of imperialism. It's the perfect empire cocktail, and it's a Christianity willing to use the sword. It'll always end up in empire. Christianity plus violence, the willingness to use violence, will always end up with empire. There's no way around it. So if you weaponize the teachings of Jesus, they become imperial. And this is what's happened. Now, this causes a problem, because I'm convinced that this way of thinking, even for us that don't like it, has infiltrated our doctrines and our subtle thinkings. Like, we talk about the supremacy of Christ, and this is why I'm an anarchist. Sometimes I can tell people they just mean that, okay, there's all these kings on earth, right? Or presidents, and Jesus trumps. He's like a king like them, but more. So they have to do what King Jesus says. Rather than Jesus being the sort of king that, in some ways, subverts kingship entirely. Like, I think us using the language of Lord and King almost doesn't even make sense with Jesus. That's probably why they used it. They were subverting a whole bunch of stuff. This is why, you know, Jen was talking about the unkingdom. Like, I do unkingdom work. Jesus is the unkingdom, is the unking of the unkingdom of God. Because the kingship of Jesus is so subversively different than any form of kingship, that it probably doesn't even make sense to call him a king. Because what we think is just Jesus who trumps. The supremacy of Christ among the nations, rather than the subservience of Christ among the nations, which is probably closer to the truth, right? For two millennia, we Christians have been complicit in the deepest sins of Western civilization. We've given sanction and justification for it. For a long time, we just needed the theologians to write out the theological defense before we could do it. Okay. No doubt, Christianity has contributed to some of our greatest triumphs in our civilization. I mean, something that can create St. Francis of Assisi can't be all bad, right? Such a nice garden statue he is. So there's lots of things that can inspire us in our Western Christian history. It's not all evil. Like, just to be black and white about it is not helpful, but It's all wrapped up in a giant steaming pile of complicity, of which we are the recipients of. And we can bemoan that and criticize it, but we fall danger into being like saying, well, yeah, they weren't real Christians like us. And that's not very confessional. So usually these kinds of moves, like in this, here's the thing, I'm a Mennonite, so the best way I've found to like be to wash my hands of all this is just by becoming Mennonite, right? They didn't kill anybody. There's a lot of Mennonites like that. It's interesting to me, like, you know why I was telling someone last night about this, that Mennonites are essentially agricultural mercenaries brought in by the empire. So, hey, let's wipe out a bunch of people. Now, those Native Americans didn't know how to make the land very productive now, did they? Who can we get? Let's give the land to as many settlers as we can. Those Mennonites, they're fleeing persecution. Let's give them the land. We ask them not to criticize us. Those Amish people, we can let them do their own thing as long as they don't cause us any troubles, and they're going to make the land productive. And so, to this day, you go, and like outside of Philadelphia, the Mennonites have made the land very productive. They got land from the Quakers. I once spoke at a Sunday school, and I was just became a Mennonite, and I'm still filled with Mennonite radical ideas. And Sunday school in this church that was very affluent, and I didn't know there were affluent Mennonites. That shows how naive I was. Like, come on. I just thought they were like Little House on the Prairie people. I really didn't understand it to the extent. So I go there, and there's like this giant wooden cross section of a tree, and it had a little dot towards the middle, like, this is where the country was founded. But look, our church is older than the country. And they had this, like, proudly displayed. We've been here longer than America. And I go to this, I'm starting to feel uncomfortable at this point, and I go to do my Sunday school talk about, like, living simply and loving the poor, blah, blah, blah. And there's this guy, you could tell, like, they were all clean kept, you know, well cut, clean people, except for there's this guy who looked a little disheveled and had kind of glasses a little crooked and his hair was a little messy. You could tell he was the wild progressive of the group. He raised his hand and I could tell people kind of look away like, oh God, Jerry's going to say something, like that kind of a thing. He says, how do you challenge empire when you are empire? Because we're the empire around here. And I thought, oh, yay, somebody's naming something. So I just joked, said, well, Jesus said, sell everything you have and give it to the poor. And I thought I was saying something funny. Silence and stares. So there's no moral place outside of which in this continent you can stand and be clean and pure. Even those traditions that somehow, like Quakers and Mennonites, like we've never done violence, we've just benefited from the violence of others. Those people are still complicit too. I'm complicit. We're all complicit. We didn't have to do it. We're benefiting from it. So this is a grim problem. This is all setting up the problem. We have this tainted Christianity we've inherited, but we like Jesus a lot, and we know that it's kind of a lame move to somehow be a I love Jesus but not religion sort of person who doesn't hang out with people and just goes on your own, because that just falls into another myth of America, of individualism. So we're trapped. We don't know what to do, but we have to be honest and confessional, but we want to do something about it. We have to embody something because we're Christians. We are incarnational. This is the challenge. And it's hard to do because you can start quoting Jesus and it doesn't matter. People don't care. We live in a society that's the largest military machine in the world is from our society that can build and erect a monument to Dr. Martin Luther King without any sense of irony whatsoever. You can even have Colin Powell talk about it. Right? And it was during a time of wars that were started by someone who claimed that Jesus Christ was his favorite moral philosopher. George W. Bush said that, remember? Jesus was his favorite philosopher. You need to go back to school, dude. To me, the starting point for this is, there's this old German word. One of the things I like about Mennonites is they have German words laying around still. And one of these German words is Gelassenheit. And this is where I want to lean into this a little bit. Gelassenheit was this German idea that actually was borrowed from people like Meister Eckhart, who was the mystic in the Middle Ages, who kind of the papa of mystics almost. Everyone likes quoting Meister Eckhart because it's hard to know whatever he's actually meaning, so you can basically appropriate him however you want. But Glassenheit has translated this ideal of letting go-edness or yieldedness. And there's this early Anabaptist writer who had a tract called Concerning the True Soldier of Christ. Now, Anabaptists using soldier metaphor is meant to be subversive because they didn't like killing people. The Glassenheit can be kind of summarized by this phrase from this tract. May I give up for love's sake, O Lord, even the things that you have given me. That's the idea of Glassenheit. A willingness to give up everything for love's sake, even things that are gifts of God. And to me, this is the challenge. When the gospel goes out, especially if you read Luke and Acts, there's this whole subversive economic reality going on, right? And there's this whole, if you know anything about the Old Testament idea of the Jubilee is embedded in every word in Luke and Acts. It's kind of the prime directive of Luke and Acts. That's why there's the contrast between the poor and the wealthy, and there's the redistribution that happens throughout Luke and especially in the beginning of Acts. It's Jubilee. That's the vision. And so Jesus comes and he does this Jubilee talk in Luke 4, which is interesting. It's the first time anyone tries to kill him is in his hometown. I always imagine that somebody in that group of people who wants to kill Jesus had babysat him at one point. Right? So this is a pretty horrifying thing. Jubilee is not just good news to the poor. It's also good news to the wealthy. This is why when you have Jesus towards, like in Luke, he talks to the rich young ruler who says, no thanks. We also hear about Zacchaeus. It's good news to the wealthy. And to me, Glassenheit is a spirituality that we as people who are the rich young rulers of our world have to embrace. Now it's interesting, I spend entirely too much time on Facebook, and I had this conversation with a lot of people that was fascinating. I was talking about the rich young ruler and how this is a story that should animate our imaginations, and everyone will always go this way with it, right? Well, the rich young ruler, he had a problem. He had an idol in his own personal heart of wealth. And Jesus would come to us and talk about whatever our idol is. We're not all the rich young ruler. It doesn't have anything to do with money exactly. It has to do with the idols in our heart. And I always find that fascinating. It's as though in the United States, the average American citizen doesn't have an idol of money in their heart. Like, you're right. First century Jews had way bigger problem with wealth than Americans have today. I'm sorry. You're right. Secondly, the script, like Luke and Acts just talks, it's just money everywhere. Jubilee, woe to the rich, blessed are the poor. And then after Jesus talks about this, he tells his disciples in Luke 12, hey, sell everything you have and give it to the poor. He says it to them first. It's not just to the rich young ruler. Gets to the rich young ruler, there's a series of these archetypal discipleship moments between rich young ruler and Zacchaeus being the two archetypal wealthy responses to the gospel. It's very built right into the structure. It has everything to do with money. The problem is for us, we don't like the idea of us being like the rich young ruler. It's amazing. Every time I've ever preached on that passage, I've never had anybody come up to me and ask this. You know, I think you're right. How do I start? I've heard probably hundreds of people say, you know, this young ruler had an idol in his heart. That was his personal problem. And Jesus is, you know, like they go there, right? Glassenheit. How do we give up even things that we would even consider God has given us? We don't have to name wealth as a horrible, evil curse that's based upon the exploitation of the New World and the slaves that we brought over from Africa, that is continually used through the continual exploitation of indigenous lands and through the exploitation of the developing world for the sake of our globalized economy. We don't have to even believe that to give up wealth. It helps, and it's true. When we realize that our exploitation and oppression is in the present tense, this is fascinating because, you know, often when I hear people talk about indigenous issues, they almost always refer to Native Americans in the past tense. Have you ever noticed that? As though it's not a current issue. Like, there's still these reservations and there's still exploitation and there's still these people who've had their land taken away. Or like slavery in the past tense, as though that legacy of slavery isn't still with us. We're all historical people, like it was said. And so it's easy. We can just always assume that we're, every moment, like when I was born with a clean slate, and I just have to make good choices. And so basically, if I maybe tithe, I'm a moral person. We've assumed that our only requirement is charity. This is where I'm going to transition here a little bit, practically. One of the great myths of our society is that we're generally neutral people, and that every time we do charity, we do good. And that's a lie, because charity, at best, is a survival program. That's what the Black Panthers called these sorts of things, survival programs, because it kept people alive long enough for justice to happen. Charity is not justice. Charity is keeping people alive. Justice is what happens when Jubilee occurs. And so churches are transfixed with this idea of justice, or of charity, but we don't really do much justice. That's the challenge for us. I'm trying to teach my son these things, and you might not approve of how I do it, but the other day I heard him re-quoting something I told him a couple months ago. He is playing with a plastic sword, which horrifies me as a Mennonite. I can't win. He wants a sword. He gets them from somewhere. I don't even know where they come from. He has this plastic cheap sword he has. He's like fighting around. And someone asked him, like, are you a pirate? What are you? He's like, no, I'm Robin Hood. I'm stealing from the rich who steal from the poor and giving it back to the poor. Just catch that extra addition. I'm stealing from the rich who stole from the poor to give back to the poor. Now, it's helpful because we have a tendency to have a Robin Hood. We don't steal. We don't like stealing in churches here. But we have this Robin idea that we're just giving to the poor as though they should be grateful. Oppressed people should be grateful that we, who have resources, are willing to share some of our, see the scare quotes, resources with them, and they should be happy because we're doing them a service. We even call it service. We don't think about it, oh my God, these people have been exploited by a system of which I benefit. The very small step of not even goodness, of me even moving to the place where I have a right to speak about this, is beginning to share. We don't talk about it that way. We always talk about it as though we're doing a good thing, not beginning to undo a bad thing. Do you notice that? So a lot of our imaginations, this is part of the imperial imagination, how it filters in. We do charity and we call it justice. To me, Jesus had a lot to say about this sort of stuff. He was willing to call things out as they were. And to me, the whole Christian anarchism thing, I'm going to say a little bit briefly about it. To me, anarchism, yeah, it's scary people throwing bricks through windows, but traditionally anarchism is just the idea that no people should have power over other people. And then how do we systematize that? So no rulers. Today, most anarchists have more of a problem with globalization than with the state. That's why, like most anarchists, are socialists, by the way. And it's why I don't have a problem voting anymore. To me, it's the idea of trying to get to the point where there's equity and people don't have power over on it. So what does a vision of a world without domination look like is the question that anarchists try to ask. And usually they're not very successful with it because there's a lot of problems. To me, Christo-anarchism, Christian anarchism, is the way of repentance. A lot of people have referred to it as North American first world liberation theology because Christian anarchism is interested in how do I divest my power. So that's why there's a lot of white anarchists. Now, we can complain about that, but there's a beautiful thing about it, a bunch of white people coming together saying, how do I spend my privilege and power in a way that's liberatory, which is why I'm an anarchist. It's, like Jesus, it's rejecting the three temptations of Satan, which are economic power, political power, and religious power. Bread, throw yourself off the temple, bow down and worship me, right? These three ways that Jesus could be a political, economic, and religious Messiah and ruler. He says, no, I'm going to choose the way of service and sacrifice, the cruciform way. And the challenge is, what does it look like for us to embody this? Okay, in election season, it's always amazing. I hear all of a sudden people who I haven't heard anybody, they haven't talked about the poor at all, start caring all of a sudden because Obama cares more about the poor than Romney. So they get into this stuff. And I'm not voting for either of the two major candidates. We can talk about how stupid that is if you want. Like, I understand. I understand the nuance. But it's fascinating, as I've had people tell me that I don't care about the poor because I'm willing to throw away my vote. And my clever response, which is probably lacking in nuance, is usually to say, what about the other times that you vote? And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, haha, I caught you. Every day you vote for justice, by how you spend and how you live. Politics is not how you vote, it's how you live your life. Okay, for the common good. Voting is a part of it. We can differ on how big of a part of it is, but I think everyone will agree at some level that economics and politics are embodied realities. And how we live in our society shapes that probably more than one vote can. In election cycle, we think about it as though, like, we have to influence from the top down, and we don't think that there's anything else we can do. The poor people are just out there, and they're going to suffer and die. The most powerful thing I can do is vote for someone who's going to alleviate that a little bit. And in the meantime, we'll sing in our church, and every once in a while we'll go to a food kitchen and serve up some food. Like, that's kind of, I mean, that's a trite way of analyzing it, but we know that's a lot of the reality. Churches don't think of themselves as political or economic, although some have begun to start using the word empire. Like, I've noticed this. Like, empire is all of a sudden okay to use in churches more and more. I mean, it used to be just, like, a few churches saying it. Now we can say it more and more, and I don't even offend people when I say empire all of a sudden. So somehow, we can be radically political. But talking about economics is still untouchable. Little do we realize that our politics just serves our economics. The president, in using military might, is just in service of economic realities. So if we want to subvert this and try to figure out an alternative reality, we have to start living in alternative economics. How am I doing for time? I'm okay. There's a few things I want to just highlight, but first I want to take a step back and be confessional. My first real sparking catalytic thought around economic justice happened because we were doing hospitality, and I didn't think about it as particularly a revolutionary thing. I was just doing a kind, good deed. And we were gathered around after a meal on Wednesday. And at the time we had a guy, let's call him Tom. Tom, he was HIV positive and he got cancer. And so he started to get, like, treatment, and he lost his job, and because of that he lost his apartment. So he's living with us for a time. And I was, boy, did I feel good about myself for doing that for him, right? That's how I thought about it. The end of one evening, we're sitting around after a meal, and people are like, hey, we should go to a movie. I'm like, I totally love movies. Let's go. Okay, what are we going to do? Like, started that conversation. And Tom was just a very quiet person off to the side, and it was easy to ignore him. And he was sitting there. And I know people weren't paying attention to he was there. No one was thinking about the fact he couldn't afford to come. And I knew. And I did this quick calculation in my head. Okay, if I bring Tom with and I can't really afford to get gummy bears and popcorn, so if I point him out, then that's probably going to fall on me to not have those things. And so I ended up going to the movie and getting gummy bears and popcorn. This was a decision I made. It wasn't an oversight. Now, it's just gummy bears and popcorn, right? Up until that moment, I always thought in terms of the big scale. There's a real problem with homelessness in our society. I'd be like, yeah, just right. Everyone agrees with that. We should do something about it. If we had better policy, true. Policies are not anything to make fun of. We need those things. We need policy, something that brings some level of equity so people can survive. Amen. But really, the economic injustice doesn't happen just at that level. It's the time when some dick chooses gummy bears and popcorn over friendship. Right? And it doesn't happen just when he happens to be at the same table. The truth is, every single time I have gummy bears and popcorn, I'm doing the same thing. It's just abstract at that point. So the truth is, one, our abstraction blinds us from justice. So what are we going to do about it? We have to live increasingly unabstracted lives. Right? We have to get in the point to where we feel horrible about gummy bears and popcorn. Otherwise, our imaginations, we're human beings, we can't think about it. It's why everyone always feels horrible when someone like, oh my gosh, a little girl was killed. 10,000 people were killed today in a strike. And like, we don't care about that, right? Statistics. We don't care about it, right? So we have to live in a way that where we unobstruct our economic choices. And this is where the church is uniquely suited for this, because the church is a political and economic reality. It's really, if you read Acts, it's just right there. We are a counterpolis. We're supposed to be a society within the society that, to use leftist lingo, is prefigurative. Like, we're supposed to live towards the world the way we think the world should go. The church, the body of Christ, that we're the family to the familyless. We are the people who do justice in the midst of injustice. We are the hospitable ones in the midst of inhospitality. We're the ones who live jubilee when there's no jubilee to be had elsewhere. Right? And we're to show the world this so that they could do likewise, or maybe join in on the Jesus-loving action. Either one is probably a step forward, right? So, how do we do that? First, we have to confess that that's the goal. Like, I often wonder to myself, how come, I've heard lots of sermons on Jubilee, I've never heard anyone suggest, maybe our congregation should explore a common purse. Do you know that it's not illegal to have a common purse? Common purse means, let's have everyone take their paychecks, throw it into the middle, and redistribute it, right? Now, that, some of us might not like that idea, but those of us who probably lean Marxist like the idea in principle. Everyone here who likes it in principle should consider trying to do it. You know, you can always stop doing that and say, I'm not going to get my paycheck anymore. So why not take a low anxiety, high risk situation, right? Is that the phrase, right? Let's do it. Experiment. Communal living is great. It can be a bunch of young hippies being idealist in an urban setting, but it can be other ways too. You can do communal living that explores intergenerationality, interclass issues. You can really explore a lot by living together, because it all of a sudden becomes non-abstract. Table fellowship. We minimize. I was telling this earlier to somebody, I think it was John. When I was a youngster growing up, I was invited out to dinner after church tons of times, but I can count on one hand, and I've done a lot of speaking in churches, I can count on one hand how many times I've been invited after church out to eat at a home or even a restaurant. It's maybe because I'm prickly and unfriendly or something, but I think it's because we've lost the ability to do hospitality. We think that breaking bread together doesn't mean what it used to, but it still does. We've just become abstracted to it. There's this great quote. It's a Cesar Chavez quote. Let's see if I can find it. Where did it go? Oh, I can't find the quote. But basically, if you want to become friends with someone, go eat with them is basically the quote. And it's true. We have to figure out how to eat with people, how to share, know where the food came from, try to be just with where the food came from, grow food, learn how to not be abstracted from the soil. We need to break bread with people who are going to bring up awkward things at dinner, awkward realities that are going to raise your anxiety as being a middle-class person, if you're a middle-class, or upper-middle-class, if you're upper-middle-class. Or if you're lower economic class, your own anxiety about that, so that we can bring it to the table and talk about it. Why is this? I thought we were brothers and sisters in Christ. Increasingly convinced that more than anything, Jesus' heart for the church and our society is to practice Jubilee. Practice it. We can proclaim Jubilee too, but it only really counts if we're practicing it. And the question isn't whether or not the rich young ruler applies to us, it's how do we begin to imagine what it could look like? And I think we need to be experimental. Like, you could come up with an agenda, a blueprint of what ideal Jubilee looks like, and then try to inflict it upon each other. Or you could say, you know, let's just be honest, we kind of suck at this Christianity thing. Right? What's a baby step? And let's write down a toddler step. And maybe after that, a little kid step. And then just leave it there. And after we've done those, let's reevaluate and figure out what to do next. Instead of naming it all as like, we've got to start an ashram and just do the whole like communal living. We're going to take over a small block of a city and live communally and maybe reach out to the next block next to us with the word of Jesus. Like, we can talk about those sorts of things. But it's better just to start with where we're at. What does Jubilee look like? What does it mean for us not just to redistribute wealth? Like one example that I heard of, if we're talking about the category of Jubilee, a friend in Oakland is there, when they buy houses, they're trying to figure it out. They're talking to a local indigenous group about what happens when they die or decide to sell. They're going to try to figure out how to give the houses for the whatever the disposal of that local indigenous group. We're beginning, like this is something I want to start talking about in our community. As we've talked about indigenous rights, and this used to be Dakota land, since we're nonprofit, we don't have to pay property taxes. What if we paid the equivalent of property taxes to whatever the Dakota elders thought fit? Now, does that really save the world? Does it change a lot? It changes us. It sows a seed of revolution, of some sort, of reconciliation. For us, sharing food costs, that could be a step towards Jubilee. You know, the idea of having guests in your home, doing hospitality where you're not just the host and the guest, but you're trying to make decisions, doing consensus decision-making across class lines can be Jubilee. One example I heard of in more of a traditionally institutional setting, there's a place called Maple City Health in Goshen, Indiana, where they have this setup where they had a bunch of old white Mennonite people making decisions about how to do health care, affordable health care, in a predominantly Latino neighborhood with a lot of undocumented workers. And they thought, you know, this kind of sucks. Even though they were all kind of jubilatory already by having a cap on how much doctors can make and a cap on how much janitors make so that they make approximately within the same realm of wages. They did that, which is really cool. They thought, we need to fire half of our board and ask people from the neighborhood to fill the board. And we need to have translation in our board meetings. And we have to make decisions by consensus. So they did all that, and they found that decisions took half the time. Because people had to stop for translation long enough to hear each other, which is fascinating, by the way. And they made decisions in a way that was more jubilatory, right? So there's lots of things. It doesn't mean that we just have to like try to have land reform in the United States of America, although that might help too. What does the step in front of us look like? For Amy and I, it meant we've lived at low income or lower level for a while. A lot of it wasn't intentional. but for us, it's like, okay, we can live this way. I don't need more than that. And then whatever resources come, we can just put it somewhere else. Right? My wife and I share a car, which has not been good for the car. The more shared a car is, the worse it gets towards the car. So our van that makes sounds, and it's funny, but we share the car instead of having a bunch of cars. Like little things. I mean, those aren't, in the big scheme of things, they don't do a whole lot, but what they do is they begin to reframe your economic imagination and make it unabstract. So then you can actually go do broader spectrum sort of political things because your imagination understands it better. Right? The great quote from Leo Tolstoy, who's always quotable, especially among Christian anarchists, I sit on a man's back, choking him and making him carry me, and yet assure myself and others that I'm very sorry for him and wish to ease his lot by all means, except by getting off of his back. Another way of looking at it is how do we begin to get off the back of other people? And there's all sorts of things that people have done around fair trade. But, you know, you always get this thing, like, it's so complex. I don't even know where to begin. Just how about every week you look up an ingredient that you use? I don't know. We need to stop making excuses and take maybe the energy we use to trying to figure out the plot of Lost and use that to trying to figure out economics. I think Lost is more complicated. I really do. Right? Were they dead the whole time? Is that what that was? I don't remember. I don't understand what's happening with that. That's a TV show. If those of you who got rid of your TV so that you could live more simply, thank God for you. Another thing we've done is try to do it. We're trying this again. A few years ago, right after like 2008, things went downhill, right? And we thought, oh, we're getting all these people that are homeless for the first time. They're like not really good at being homeless, you know? They're scared and they don't know how to be homeless and they're terrified. And we felt like in the subtext, it's like these people are homeless, but they're more like me, right? So I started feeling anxious for them. And so I thought, well, gee, I have tons of friends around the Twin Cities who, like, agree with how we do things. So I gathered a few people, and we started meeting, like, let's start a Christ Rooms project. Dorothy Day, who started the Catholic Work Movement, had community houses, hospitality houses, but they said that's their charism, that's their call. But every Christian in America who can afford a guest room should open it to a stranger, right? It's amazing. That never worked for them. And I thought, well, gee, we could do it. If Dorothy Day couldn't do it, but we can. So we started doing it. I contacted 50 of my likely candidates. They all said no. And then I turned to the organizers with me and said, you would do it, right? Like, why are you organizing this? Because it needs to be done. I mean, we all know, everyone agrees that it should happen. Like, I got really cynical and judgmental because of that. And so now I'm starting, I got someone send me an email, and I'm putting it all on you now if you live in the Twin Cities. Single mom and three kids, 4, 9, and 11. Her husband is in jail for 6 months. They have income, but they lost their housing, and they can afford something, but they couldn't afford what they had. I've posted it. I have like 2,000 Facebook friends. I've posted it on Facebook 3 or 4 times, sent out emails, nothing yet. My sister said, my Tea Party sister, said that she might be able to work something out, but then her boyfriend said no. So, I still think this idea has merit. Like, we've had lots of guests come through our home, and I've only been really kind of scared once. It helps that I'm 300 pounds. But let's be honest, it's not always as scary. Like, it's not these like terrifying, violent people coming into the home. Most people that we've ever had as guests are gentle and awkward, like you would be, right? What can it begin for us to think about it? Like, and people have said, well, what about like families moving forward or things where churches house people? Like, yeah, that's not the same. Like, a shelter is not the same. A shelter is often scary and alienating, and the food often sucks. I've eaten fungusy-looking shelter food, and I'm like, we can do better than this. Churches housing people up to a week before they move on is also good. It's a step forward. But becoming family, that's the goal, right? So, and usually you do that in homes. Unless our primary economic unit is really a household and we live jubilatory in our households, in our neighborhoods, then it's not going to mean much when a church does it. Like, because, you know, a lot of these times churches will do these things, but it's just a handful of people that are doing it. It's not revolutionizing a bunch of people. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or friends would let people in. Mm-hmm. There's always been drug problems. I swear. It's people who are unhappy, are on drugs, and steal things. And that is a big fear for people who live in the real world and have to leave their home and have a stranger in their house.
Mm-hmm. I also live in the real world, just for the record. I've had drug issues. Not very much. We've had more stealing. I'm like, okay, when people complain about stealing, I'm like, we told you, be careful where you leave your stuff. And that's the end of it. Now, there's ways of securing your stuff, and to be honest, like, there's all kinds of hospitality. Like, I think people go to like these extreme situations of homeless men who are inebriated. Single moms with children are less likely to be all drug addicts. There's also hospitality to undocumented workers. Like, there's a Catholic worker in St. Paul who does that. And there's ways to get to know people first. Now, it's never a guarantee, but like, here's the thing. If I recognize not everyone can do this in their home. Like, some people just don't have the ability because they're gone all the time, or they don't have space, but they know someone who does. And until maybe all of us can't be directly responsible for the day in, day out, but we can all be responsible for trying to figure out solutions that are beyond just institutional solutions of let's find more shelters or affordable housing, which are, again, necessary. But obviously, they don't finish everything. They don't take care of everything. Right? So I don't want to be a jerk about it, but I want to challenge us. We can do better. We can think about it and figure it out. Like, maybe not me, but then I can be responsible for providing support, or I can at least start talking to my friends about this or do something. I have a 4.5-year-old who lives in my house, just for full disclosure. He meets guests all the time, and there's been no issues yet. And when he gets older, to where I'm not He still has a parent with him all the time. It'll probably be different when he's older. But then there's situations that we can pursue then. My wife and I don't want to do a duplex or triplex situation, but maybe we'll consider that. I don't know what we'll decide when the kid's older. But we're going to try to figure out a way to prioritize hospitality. And I think every church should consider finding a way to prioritize it in their practices. And I recognize that I'm not trying to say there's a cookie-cutter approach that has to look a certain way. There's always the more hospitable step, and that's enough to do for now. None of us are hospitable enough compared to Jesus, so let's take the step in front of us. The last thing I want to kind of name and then open up for questions, and there's so much more I could say. Jen said this, I think Dr. Charles Amjad Ali said this. It's been brought up, I think, kind of part of the thing we're naming here is that empire is based on fear. Right? William Stringfellow and others who talk about the principalities and powers will name the driving impulse behind what categorizes a principality or power, or this social reality that kind of oppresses people, that the driving impulse behind every principality and power is survival. That's why they're vampiric. They suck life out of people and they oppress. And that the church, insofar as it prioritizes survival, is a principality and a power. Yes. And let's be honest, most churches that you've probably engaged, but I know most churches that I engaged through leadership or being a part of, and even my own community, we're all radical and stuff, but we still never name it, but we prioritize our survival. And what happens when you do that? You can't practice Jubilee and prioritize survival at the same time. You can't. You can maybe be wise about not dying all at once. But the rich young ruler, the reason he went away sad is because he knew that he'd have to give up probably his identity, his sense of self, and everything that was most meaningful to him in his life to practice Jubilee. Zacchaeus had the same choice and decided to pay everyone back who'd ever defrauded and give away half his possessions, which I'm assuming made him destitute, at least for a little while. It doesn't say he quit his job. He probably found a way to be more just in it. I don't know. It doesn't say a whole lot. But we know that there's these choices that we face. And Zacchaeus made the choice to give up, even if it meant he lost everything. The rich young ruler was not. As much as our churches prioritize our survival by keeping a big chunk of money that we sometimes tap into for our Jubilee Fund, which is just ironic. And we can justify it all we want. Like, we need to be there for people 50 years from now. That's why we're not doing justice now, so we can kind of do not justice 50 years from now. We need to stop investing in our own perpetuity. That's the way of the empire. We need to stop trying to survive. How much of the vast wealth of the churches and the society is spent on keeping things as they are? We need to give up for love's sake even the things that God has given us, which, to be honest, probably didn't come from God to begin with. The language of blessing in the society is fascinating in that regard. The challenge is we realize that we've been naming the status quo as something we need to resist and challenge. And as long as we say it's the challenge and the change has to happen out there, it won't happen. If it doesn't begin with us, where will it begin? We have to figure out what it means for us to embody justice, to be prefigurative, to be a witness to the world of what justice looks like, what peace looks like, what family looks like. We need to embody it. And I'm not saying that living in a weird commune where you're eating lots of lentils and you garden and have chickens is the way to do it. It's just a way to do it. People ask me, do you think every Christian should live like you guys live? I'm like, no, but it's a normal Christian life. What normal Christian life are you called to? I'm pretty sure most Americans, by virtue of the violence and us being foot soldiers for the empire, do not live a normal Christian life. And I can say those people aren't really Christian. Or I can say, oh God help us, they're Christians. And so am I. How do I repent of my Christianity and follow Jesus? So I guess I'll open it up to you. Yeah.